Back with you, busy show, midweek Wednesday, May 19th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Mark Fitch checked in once again from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy here in Connecticut to talk about some of the wacky ideas going on at the state capitol. Renowned explorer, yes, the guy that found the Titanic, Robert Ballard, joined us just after the news at 4 to talk about his next venture. He is not slowing down. And Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield checked in on a couple of votes that happened the previous night on two controversial bills in the General Assembly. Joining us right now is a gentleman we'd like to check in with about once a month or so to try and make sense of even the stuff I can't understand that's going on over the General Assembly that could cost you and I more money. Mark Fitch, who writes the Fitch Files column at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, is with us. Mark, it's Paul again, sir. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. It's good to be with you.
Well, thank you, sir. Thanks for putting the time aside. We appreciate it. Now, we're kind of getting to the home stretch here of this legislative session, supposedly only a couple of weeks remaining, but they may go into overtime here for pot. But you sent out some summaries the other day that I thought were interesting. Now, we're supposedly, Mark, going to be awash in all this COVID money coming from the Fed and our bond rating, our rating from the investment houses I see is up, which is good for with a little more fiscal sanity. Yet there are proposals out there for new taxes, as you point out, that would raise over $8 billion in the next few years. And I know the governor, Mark, and you and I have talked about this. These are some taxes that he is not all that keen to sign on to.
Yeah, so the Democrat leaders in the legislature actually just held a press conference today regarding talking about this. When the Finance Committee passed a budget, their budget proposal, and it included a couple major new taxes or tax increases, most of which would fall upon Connecticut's wealthy residents. So it included a capital gains surcharge of 2% that they estimate would bring in about $262 million, and then a consumption tax, or what they call a consumption tax. It's really a tax on the income of people making over $500,000 a year, which they think would bring in about $500 million per year. So when you start talking about, $1 billion in new taxes, I mean, 75% of it, you're talking right from, the top earners in Connecticut. So those are two things that, Lamont has been very steadfast in saying, no, we shouldn't do this. We don't need this right now. But, Democrats and their allies have been pushing for these kind of taxes for years, saying that they want a more progressive tax code in Connecticut. And that's the same thing they were saying today during the press conference. They're shooting for taxing the wealthy more and increasing, tax credits and things, child tax credit and the earned income tax credit for lower income individuals.
Mark, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the more progressive Democrats, are sitting in their offices with, Ned Lamont voodoo dolls, sticking pins in them because, boy, as often as he gives us this, gosh gee willikers sort of aw shucks mantra, which, as I've said to you numerous times, is a welcome departure from our previous governor, the far left of the party seems to just get more and more angry as you've got a guy here in the office who's not really a career politician, and he just says what's on his mind, especially when it comes to taxing, Mark, the exact kind of people that I'm sure Ned Lamont did business with and calls his neighbors in Fairfield County.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he lives in Greenwich. He knows these people, And this isn't even necessarily a Ned Lamont thing. I mean, even towards the end of his administration, Governor Malloy refused to do any further tax increases on the wealthy. He'd already done it twice. And he knew that that was getting us nowhere as far as a budget. And, Republicans and Governor Lamont have both said, we're looking at budget surpluses right now. We have a maxed out rainy day fund at a little more than $3 billion in there. and we have all this federal money, so much that we're arguing what to do with it, and yet the Democrat leaders are talking about tax increases. So really what it comes down to, this isn't a fiscal situation. This isn't what's guiding this isn't, you know, fiscal problems or budgetary problems. What's guiding this is ideology.
Sure.
And
they see
the opportunity to, you know, kind of go after the group of people that they want to go after.
Yeah, it's a case of, you know, who runs this joint? Hey, Ned, you were just elected. We've been here, some of us, in the General Assembly for years. Mark, hang on. I want to come back and talk about something you you pointed out to me and this thing you sent me regarding an offshore bank account. God, you can't figure this stuff out. Can't make it up either. Traffic and weather together. 3:36 on WICC. Yeah, a lot of people in Ansonian, wherever, want to know what happens with their tax revenues, state money that, they pay out of their pockets, and they want accountability for it. Mark Fitch joins us from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. He keeps an eye on this stuff, writing the Fitch files. And you refer to something here, as Republicans do in Hartford, Mark, as an quote-unquote kind of an offshore bank account, which it really isn't. But now there's rumblings here, you tell me, Mark, of a separate investment fund that would take state money and have, what, a closed circle of people to decide what to do with it?
Yeah, this was also a proposal out of the Finance Committee. And, you know, Republicans, you know, labeled it an offshore bank account because, frankly, it kind of is. It would create what's called the Equitable Investment Fund. And a lot of money in their proposed taxes, I mean, just about all of the money, would go into this Equitable Investment Fund. So we're talking not only the capital gains surcharge and the consumption tax, but also tax revenue from marijuana and sports gambling would all go into this Equitable Investment Fund. And that would be managed by a board of 9 people, which only includes 2 elected officials. That'd be the governor and the state treasurer, and the rest would be political appointees. So it's kind of seen as, you know, the money would never go to the general fund, so it wouldn't be appropriated. It would go directly into this Equitable Investment Fund. And so it would bypass the General Assembly's oversight, and it would also essentially bypass the state's constitutional spending cap. So it gets around both of those things. And while the – yeah, I know. But and this is something that also came up during the press conference today.
What did they say? How did they justify this today? Did they say anything about it?
Yeah, they did. They did talk about it today. So the reception to the Equitable Investment Fund has been somewhat cool. You know, as much as – the, you know, Democrat leaders, you know, like talking about equity and investing in cities and things like that, they're a little more hesitant on this particular fund, but they did say that it's still an idea that they are working with, and it's still something that they want to do in some capacity. Whether or not it's this full-fledged capacity that came out of the Finance Committee remains to be seen, and they'll be entering into budget negotiations with the Lamont administration very soon, I think starting tomorrow. And, yeah, so it would kind of be this offshore bank account. Now, whether or not that actually happens, we'll see. But at the same time, they are looking for some kind of other fund that they can use to focus in on cities, essentially.
You know, Mark, it's interesting that in the relationship, the dichotomy we have here between the governor and the big city legislators, primarily Hartford and New Haven, to a little bit of a lesser extent, Bridgeport around here. Boy, this idea, Mark, of equity and channeling money to the cities, they're really using that as like Thor's hammer against the governor here. And it's not like these areas, Mark, are teetering on becoming red or purple. This is still blue Connecticut, but man, this whole quote-unquote equity thing in so many of these issues, they're really trying to pummel Lamont with it.
Oh, well, I mean, equity is kind of just the new phrase. I mean, they're attaching it to just about every bill that comes down. There's always some kind of mention of equity. And it's even causing some problems. And when you start talking about the marijuana legalization bill, there's so much argument around equity in that bill that it threatens to not even pass because they can't reach agreement as to what equity is in that legislation. And they're it gets used for to justify tax increases. It gets used to justify different payment formulas to cities or schools. It's really, like you said, it's being used as Thor's hammer on just about everything. And I think it's going to get to the point where it becomes a bit of a problem for some of the Democrats as well. And but during the press conference today, I think it was Senator Looney, the Senate President Pro Tem, said that equity is the name of the game this session. This is what they've decided that they wanted to do with this session, is really make this their focus.
And why? Because there are no face-to-face public hearings. Mark, hang on. When we come back, I want you to tell us about something that only could happen with the word union associated with it. Mark Fitch is the guest from the Yankee Institute. Mark, hang on. 3:46, traffic and weather together on WICC. A few more minutes with our buddy, our pal, Mark Fitch. He writes the Fitch Files column for the Yankee Institute of Public Policy here in Connecticut. So we've talked about possibility of more taxes, funny money with a separate account here. So let's segue here, Mark, in the couple of minutes we finally have left over with you here on a Wednesday to talk about something that only you can explain to me and our listeners, because this has to do with a union election coming up, and it's just so Connecticut. Tell us about this one.
I believe you're talking about the Connecticut Police and Fire Union election.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, one of the individuals running for union president is a guy named Charles Chuck Delaraco, and he was formerly president of the Judicial Employees Union here at the state. He was a Supreme Court police officer and head of the union there. It was a large union, about 1,500 people. And he was president of it for a while. But when the Supreme Court moved to get rid of their police officers and replace them with judicial marshals, he ended up being able to cut himself a deal in that he filed a bunch of grievances against the judicial department and then settled them by getting a deal in which he was allowed to take a year of union leave time in order to campaign for his union reelection.
Oh, man.
And so he was off for a year running around doing his campaigning. And then he inadvertently broke his deal by filing another grievance and ended up getting bounced out of the Judicial Employees Union and was transferred over to become an animal control officer. So now he's doing that job, and now he's running for president of the Connecticut Police and Fire Union. And, this is a guy that has an interesting, colorful past, we'll say. I'm not sure how that election's going to go. I've heard different things.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where it's, these actors, sometimes bad actors, keep coming back and remaining in positions of power where they have a lot of influence over state employees.
Mark, I was almost going to ask you, as you were describing this, like his background, like for a flow chart, to kind of just follow this along. But yeah, that'll certainly be interesting. Finally, Mark, and I've had guests about this on constantly over the past year and a half, this transportation climate initiative, which, Mark, I think much like tolls, I don't think the proponents of this, now I could be wrong here, Mark Fitch, but I don't think the proponents of this expected the blowback they're getting on this.
It's tough to say. Whenever you start talking about raising gas prices, you can expect some blowback. What they're really trying to avoid is calling it a tax. And this really gets under the proponent's skin if you call it a tax. And unfortunately, Governor Lamont has, occasionally called it a tax himself. He referred to it as a carbon tax. But the idea of this, you know, extra price increase and the money goes to the government, you can have the argument whether or not it's a tax, but, you know, frankly, you just pay more at the pump and the money goes to the state. So however you want to define that. And, yeah, so the Republicans joined with No Tolls Connecticut having rallies around the state, and they're having them. And, you know, the Lamont administration and some supporting senators, Senator Will Haskell and Christine Cohen, they've been kind of upping the ante, pushing this a little harder in recent days. You know, I'm not – they say that they have strong Democrat support, and frankly, that's all they need with mm-hmm. such an imbalanced General Assembly. Mm-hmm. But it makes you question, being that they're coming out so forcefully against opponents of TCI, whether or not they're concerned that they have the votes. So, yeah, I mean, you're talking a 5 to 10 cent, you know, gasoline cost increase in the first year, you know, and from there, it's kind of who knows, because the way this is set up, it makes calculations tough. A lot of people have taken runs at it and gotten different numbers, but it's tough to know who to believe.
Mark, as always, thank you for laying all this out for us and stuff that even the dopey host here can understand. Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out online, yankeeinstitute.org. Mark writes the Fitch Files. Mark, always good to speak with you. We'll be in touch. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much,
Paul. All right, appreciate it. Mark Fitch there from the Yankee Institute. All right. Honored to welcome a gentleman here who's been described by at least one person as larger than life. Scientist, engineer, naval intelligence officer, charmer in chief. I like that one. Robert Ballard is the guest. You know him as the gentleman who, found the Titanic, but he also has found other ocean phenomena, hydrothermal vents. He also found artifacts in the Black Sea. And, of course, the Titanic, the Bismarck, the Lusitania, JFK's PT-109. New book by Mr. Ballard, co-authored with Christopher Drew, Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. Robert Ballard, Paul Pacelli here, sir. How are you? Good afternoon.
I'm doing fantastic. What a beautiful day, although we jumped into summer awful
fast. About that, huh? And my sinuses are telling me that, Bob. I mean,
yeah, the pollen. Oh my gosh, you could write your letters in that.
At least when you're looking for a shipwreck, there's no pollen to deal with, or is there when you're out in the middle of an ocean?
Well, I don't know. We got total darkness. That's our problem. It's black where we go.
The name of the book, Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. Robert, you know, when you see the word memoir, people say, oh, man, this is it. Here comes.
I know they're going to throw dirt in your face before you know it, but not true.
Well, here comes. This is the one. So-and-so or she or he has written his memoir or her memoir. Was this a case, Bob, of
no,
just
not
looking?
At all. No, I actually read the wrong definition of retiring. I went into Webster's Dictionary. And there was another definition of it that said halfway through the Indianapolis 500, the drivers go into the pit and get a new set of tires, and it's called retiring. And so that's what I've done. I've got a whole new program laid out for the next 10 years, but I needed to button up the one I just been on for 60 years. So this was a perfect time to do it. Plus, in this particular one, I really talk about some of the secrets behind what I've been doing, some of them military, but some of them personal. The fact that I'm dyslexic, and it's not something I knew about until I was in my 60s, but immersing myself in the dyslexic world, I realized what a gift it is. It really made me who I am, and I'm so excited about being dyslexic, but I'm trying to convince those other kids that have been told they're dumb that have dyslexia, that it is a gift, not a curse.
You didn't realize it or embrace it until you were in your 60s? How is that?
Well, the word wasn't around when I was born in 1942. Yeah. And when we moved from Kansas, where all oceanographers are born, to California, and I was struggling to read, my mom said, oh, you missed phonics during. And so I just accepted it that I missed phonics, whatever that was. And that I just had to deal with it, and I did. And I figured out ways to work around it, but it wasn't until I was driving along and I heard on the radio an interview with two people, experts in dyslexia, named Brock and Fernetti Ide, who wrote the seminal book, The Dyslexic Advantage. And I knew my daughter had dyslexia, but I didn't know the linkage that it's generational. And I knew my wife is definitely not dyslexic. So I got the book, and I must say, it took me a while to read it, but I cried when I read it because I knew I was different, but it explained me to me, and it was quite seminal. And Chris Drew and National Geographic put an amazing team onto this project and really delved into being dyslexic and how I was able to turn it to be a great gift.
I was just going to ask you that, Robert Ballard. Was this in some odd way or unknown way or unforeseen way, was this helping you all those years?
It was.
How?
When you read it, in fact, it's sort of interesting. I'm working with the Geographic team and Chris Drew's team, and I said, so when are we going to tell everyone I'm dyslexic? And they're going to say, not until you learned. And I said, well, that's going to be pretty far in. They said, we'll drop little hints along the way, but we're going to do it when you figured it out, and then show how it then changed your life and why I'm now standing on a soapbox yelling and screaming about it, because it is a gift, but you need to know how to use it. How do you cope? How do you alter your path? Because remember that the rules are written by non-dyslexics. So I would love to write a whole set of rules for that non-dyslexics would have a real tough time following. So, no, it's something I really want. I think it's time for dyslexics to come out of the closet, because most people will not talk about it.
To your career, you said you want to button up some details now, 60-plus years in, before you enter the next chapter for the next 10 years. If your epitaph, Robert Ballard, was, oh, the guy that found the Titanic, would that be okay with you or not?
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, you know, in the book, my mom said, too bad you found that rusty old ship. But it's why we're on the phone, isn't it? But I'm talking about other things. And that's the point is yes, Titanic gave me a lot of notoriety, some helpful, but other not in academia. I was really hammered for doing it by my academic peers. I had to prove myself to be a scientist 10 times over. But I also just see it as a way of beginning a conversation that leads somewhere else. I mean, yes, there's a lot into the book about finding the Titanic, but it also goes into how I figured out how to do it. Because of my dyslexic mind, I went about it in a very unconventional way. It's fine.
Did that make you angry, though, when you had all these? And I know what you're talking about, because I've read over the years, oh, leave it alone. It's a quote-unquote gravesite, whatever.
No, it's okay. It's okay, because quite honestly, the deep sea, think about it. There's the United Nations has estimated there's 3 million, that's a big number, shipwrecks in the ocean. And we've found a tiny amount of them. And what I also discovered in the deep sea, not only with the Titanic and the Bismarck and PT-109, but in the ancient shipwrecks where I was exploring in the Black Sea, where there's no oxygen, ships are perfectly preserved. We found a ship, 300 BC, that had human remains on it because it's perfectly preserved. The largest museum on Earth is beneath the sea. There's more history in the deep sea than all the museums of the world combined, and I want to let the next generation know that their generation are the real generation of explorers. Their generations, thanks to not only the technology we pioneered with the Titanic, but what we're now using today, will make it possible for their generation to explore more of Earth than all previous generations combined. We are just at the beginning of exploring and understanding our planet.
We climb mountains, we drill big holes, we go to the moon, we build a space station, now we're heading to Mars. Robert Ballard, does oceanography, the exploration of nature and shipwrecks, the stuff you've been doing for decades, does that get the short shrift sometimes?
Well, it has, because, you know, as I said in the book, God's upstairs and we're downstairs. So there's a people are sort of prepositioned to want to look at the heavens. But I must tell you, every time I watch some program on space, I watch them violate every law of physics. So many of the programming you see just isn't possible. But that doesn't seem to stop people.
Yeah.
So, but I'm okay with that. But I would just like to have the human race spend as much time exploring. For example, my new mission. I've been funded by NOAA's Office of Ocean Exploration to conduct the second Lewis and Clark expedition. That's what I'm now going to do. That's the next book in 10 years. And as we all know, in the Lewis and Clark expedition, there was only one woman, Sacagawea, who, by the way, saved their lives. My team, my core, is 55% women. And so we have been charged to explore the 50%, think about this, 50% of the United States that lies beneath the sea. We have better maps of Mars than we have of our own country, the 50% beneath the sea. But we've now been given an amazing grant from NOAA to conduct what we now call the Lois and Clark expedition. And so that's what we embark upon this year. And so knowing that was coming, knowing that it was going to run for 10 years, so I got to come back in 10 years and tell you we found. But you can, by the way, follow it live. Our ship, I have a ship named after my hero, Captain Nemo. My ship is the Nautilus. Mm-hmm. And if you go to nautiluslive.org, on July 3rd, we set sail.
Excellent. Robert, hang on. I want to just spend a few more quick minutes with you. Robert Ballard is the guest telling us about what is coming up. Amazing. The second Lewis and Clark expedition, a follow-up for that in the next 10 years. The new book, though, is called Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. A few more minutes with Robert Ballard coming up after Traffic and Weather Together on WICC. A couple of minutes remaining with a true explorer in the greatest sense. Robert Ballard is with us. He has co-authored with Christopher Drew his new book, Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. Yes, that Robert Ballard. He's also found the Bismarck, the Lusitania. You remember that? JFK's PT-109 as well. Robert, I am fascinated by this new adventure. Tell us more about that. And I have always wondered, Robert, about, the sea is great, the heavens are great, but I've always wondered, as you mentioned, how far have we drilled under the terra firma here, the country?
Well,
it's not
like
much,
said,
is it?
Most people don't realize that 50% of the United States of America lies beneath the sea, and we own it. Remember when Jefferson cut the deal with Napoleon?
Yeah.
Napoleon picked a fight with England, lost, not a good day for him. He had to pay them a war debt, and he didn't have the money. So he came to Jefferson and said, I want to sell you the Louisiana Purchase. Now, by the way, Congress was opposed to it, surprised. But Jefferson went ahead, reached into his pocket, and purchased the Louisiana Purchase. He doubled the size of the United States, and it completely altered the economy of our nation. When you saw the ranches and farms and you look at what the economy was pre a Louisiana Purchase. It was cotton. It was slaves. It was totally focused on Europe. And then when we opened up the West, my gosh, it changed everything. Well, when President Reagan was president, he picked up a pen. And for the price of a pen, not $21 million, signed a law called the Law of the Sea that extended America's legal jurisdiction 200 miles out to sea from all its shores, plus any more that you could prove was a part of our continent. And he did what Jefferson did. He doubled the size of the United States. I served on a commission later that said we need to have, for the first time in the history of our country, a Office of Ocean Exploration. Didn't have one. Well, we created it. It's in NOAA. And then we began to explore. And they put out a competitive contract. And I formed a group of organizations, Woods Hole, the University of New Hampshire, University of Southern Mississippi, University of Rhode Island, and the Ocean Exploration Trust based in Connecticut. And we won that competition. And we've now been given the job to begin exploring the 50% of our country that lies beneath the sea, it will change the economy of our nation.
What do you think you're going to find there? Do you have any idea, Robert?
Well, what's really cool about what we do, we're now using robots. And I have, if we were, and if I was doing this on Zoom, I you could see the command center I live in. I have a command center because here's the deal we have. So I got my ship, the Nautilus. You go to nautiluslive.org, learn all about it. It goes, it boldly goes where no one has gone before on planet Earth, and in this case, America, the unknown America. So we're just like Lewis and Clark paddling along, and we make a discovery. So here's what we do. We're able to beam our discovery off the ship in real time. I built over at Rhode Island the Inner Space Center with the University of Rhode Island, where I have a, also a faculty position. There, we can then network it out. So here's what happens. We explore 24 hours a day. Okay, we're going to be going to sea next year 10 months a year. So for 10 months, we're going to be exploring. And so we bump into something. And we bump into something, and we say, well, we don't have any experts aboard that know what we're doing. So we have a watch leader that has a, literally a book that has all the experts in America in various disciplines that's volunteered to be bothered. It's sort of our version of doctor on call. So let's say we make a discovery. We always seem to make them about 2 o'clock in the morning. Sunday. So we make a discovery 2 o'clock in the morning. We look in the book. Who's the expert? The expert is Larry Steger at Harvard. Okay, we pick up the phone. We call Larry. We wake him up in bed and say, Larry, boot up your laptop. We're going to stream the discovery to you. Tell us what to do. And to be a doctor on call, they have to be within 20 minutes of a remote command center like the ones I have. We've built them all across the United States. So we can then beam that person down to the bottom of the ocean. We move their spirit, not their body. And this technology is going to revolutionize how we do. COVID-19 was an introduction. You call it Zoom. We've been doing that for years. It's called telepresence. So you're going to have this in your home where you're going to literally, I'll venture within 10 years, you'll be renting robots from Hertz to drive around in the Serengeti, and you'll get a phone bill, and you won't leave a carbon footprint. So this is a revolutionary technology called telepresence that kind of changed how the human race acts and lives. Thank goodness, because we need to stop moving bodies around when we can move spirits around for next to nothing.
Amazing. Robert, thank you. Name of the book, folks, go out and grab it. It's getting just fabulous reviews. Into the Deep, a memoir from the man who found Titanic. We've been joined today by that man who is not slowing down and now is going to let us know what is in a lot of the U.S. that we don't know, Robert Ballard. Robert, thank you. We appreciate the time. Good luck.
Thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it. Robert Ballard. How about that, folks? State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield on a couple of things that have happened in the General Assembly over the past 24 hours or so. Tony, it's Paul here. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Great to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Tony, for sparing the time. And I want to talk about a couple of things. I know there was a vote late yesterday, Tony, and it's on a bill, obviously, that on the surface of it, it's something I think that most people can have a frank discussion about, racism being a public health crisis, this, that, and the other. But I know you were up there voicing a concern that when I read it I thought was quite valid, is that there are certain things, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, in how that bill was handled that you and I know a few other members of the state Senate had a problem with as far as the proper process is concerned. Talk about that.
Absolutely. I mean, this bill, Senate Bill 1, is addressing the idea that racism is a public health crisis accentuated and exacerbated by the COVID pandemic and the disparity of health care. It's a valid consideration, and we worked very diligently through the committee. It was a significant bill that was over 20-plus sections, and we had public debates and public hearings, and it was well and good. We had many objections, and it was a work in progress, as promised. But nevertheless, the bill appeared yesterday. It had an amendment that we had scant hours to review that proposed new additions of work groups and new considerations that did not have a real transparent, I guess the best word I could say, Paul, it was a very opaque process. Now, that being said, it looked at convening commissions of reviewing processes and analysis of how we can address disparity of care across racial, race-based kind of biases, and they're valid. But we also added in there a consideration regards to a gun violence advisory group that we never had a debate in public health in regards to public hearing and engagement, because we had a brief gathering. It was not in the original bill. But I think most important of all, it is ultimately an important and valuable idea. But, Paul, it was a reflection, again, of a one-party rule system where we get a significant policy bill in which many people agreed, as you can tell by the vote of 30-5 opposed, that we really didn't have a transparent and responsible process. But that's the problem when you have one-party Democratic rule, because they ruled it out, and it was according to plan. They had the votes, and they pushed it through. What I did was spending a very long time going through section by section to ensure that legislative intent was put on public record and having a better transparent exchange of why these changes were made and the relevance of it as applicability. And I thought it was important because we didn't have that transparent process in the committee work. And unfortunately, should this become law, I wanted to be sure that there were legislative intent in how we would apply these laws, because I never had a thorough and transparent public process.
All right, Tony, hang on. I'll be right back with you. I want to talk about, again, this is another controversial bill there, the Clean Slate Bill. I've had legislators on both sides of the aisle on this, and also some representatives of victims of crime who are a little uneasy with this. Tony, hang on first. Traffic and weather together. How about that? 4:36 on WICC. Coming up on 4:41, more traffic and weather together. Straight ahead, look at Wall Street, too. Less than 10 minutes away, Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield joining us once again, friend of the radio station here. But I wanted to have Tony on to talk about a couple things. One, the bill declaring racism a public health crisis. We talked about that. There was another bill, though, that I've done some shows on here, and this is this Clean Slate Bill, which at its core, a lot of people agree with. Let's not have things hanging over people's heads unnecessarily, primarily misdemeanors and some maybe low-level felonies that may hamper them from getting a job, getting a loan, really for those who've turned their lives around. Now, there's a difference, a lot of people say, in acknowledging someone has rehabilitated themselves versus saying that these things technically never happened, wiping a person's slate clean, hence the name of the bill. And Tony, back to you. I know there was a vote yesterday to clear it out of the Senate, but I know there's still a bit of controversy, Tony, on some of the felonies that, correct me if I'm wrong, that would be wiped clean here, to the point where I guess they would no longer be on someone's record. And I know that's raised a few eyebrows here.
Far too many for me. And it obviously is a noble concept. And I do genuinely believe in second chance and forgiveness and giving individuals an opportunity for good people that have made mistakes and paid their debt to society to be able to have a fresh start. And many components of it, looking at misdemeanors on this, can be cleared with a demonstrated record of time served, but also a record of good behavior. But we also, I think, went too far. We are looking at aggravated felonies. We are looking at individuals that have committed negligent homicide, as well as in the area of domestic violence and stalking. To be able to have that slate cleared is troubling for me. And the irony is not lost, and it should not be lost on people, because hours before we voted on this Clean Slate Bill, we proudly passed a bill that reinforced the advocacy against domestic violence and the protection of individuals and victims that have been subject to perpetrators and stalking and domestic violence and the impact it has, not only from the immediate action, but the trauma continually. And we are allowing the possibility that individuals like that have perpetrated violent, potentially emotionally traumatizing and victimizing crimes to now go back out into society and say, you know what? It's a clean slate. And for me, I think this bill goes a bit too far. Well-intentioned, it has every noble effort to be able to give people a second chance and an opportunity for a clean start, for housing, for jobs. Many of the dynamics are there, but there are certain criminal acts. There are certain victims that have individual victims and their loved ones and families who will never be able to recover their peace, never recover the loved ones that have been lost. And will they ever have a clean slate? To me, that's not possible. And so for us, maybe we are going a step too far in this and saying, let's give everybody a clean chance. But you know what? Not everybody is rehabilitated. Not everybody is always a good person. And I'm also very concerned about victim rights, because particularly on the area of domestic violence, as I shared, the trauma never leaves. And the idea that an individual can now live free and clear despite the trauma that victims must continually live with seems patently unfair to me.
And Tony, yeah, this is the thing I think I want to make a lot of people aware of here. And I think there's some kind of a little misconception here where people see second chance and they say, okay, rehabilitation. You know, even people that have committed felonies, a lot of them have said, yeah, I had no idea what the hell I was doing back then. Wrong crowd. I've been fine for the past 30 years. But there's a difference, Tony, between letting somebody rehabilitate their life, which is great, but then saying this is no longer on their record. That never happened. I mean, it's almost, Tony, and I don't want to take this too far, but I think this is accurate. You know, some countries, some repressionist regimes, you know, they erase history. We can't do that, Tony. I think, and that's the thing, and I've had people tell me about this bill, said, well, it would limit, maybe in the final version of it, the ability of prosecutors or boards of parole and pardon to actually see previous records. That's the part I think a lot of people may not understand here.
Without a doubt. And as I said earlier, the noble idea and the idea of forgiveness and second chance and being able to create opportunities for people, good people that have made mistakes is important. But we may have gone too far in this. If we kept it at certain crime levels and have no demonstrated victim traumas that are ever significant, perhaps. But again, people have made mistakes, and it's mistakes that people will have to live with. And part of the society's role is not to create a clean slate, but to create a tolerance and an understanding and create opportunities. As a champion advocate of second chance opportunities, these are individuals that are striving to overcome the obstacles that they have encountered, obstacles that is a part of their history. But it strives for them to work harder to make a better difference, and it comes into housing, it comes into further career skills development to break out the poverty cycle or substance cycle, abuse cycle that led them to those criminal behaviors. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, these are valuable lessons to be learned. It is a convenience of society in this present day and age to say, let's wipe it clean, let's begin anew. Yeah. But the reality is, there are many victims who aren't unable to live on their lives because they've lost loved ones or forever traumatized by it. What are the relief for them? And the possibility, could some individuals relapse and commit the same level of crime against new victims? We can't. We have to balance that. Well-intentioned, yes, but protection of public health and individuals with a past history of those kind of violent acts needs to have an additional caution.
Tony, refresh me. Has this passed the House already, or does it have to go to the House and then to the governor?
It would need to go to the House for a vote. And
so any chance there could be changes where you could refine those felonies a little bit?
we proposed many amendments in the Senate debate last night into the late hours to say there's certain individuals, certain penalties and crimes that should not be part of this clean slate. And unfortunately, as we do in that building, it's one party rule, partisan divide, and it just made no sense. It just really turned on me the irony that hours before, Paul, we were debating about the importance of protecting victims of domestic violence, the victim trauma of stalking and living in fear. And then at the same term, we're saying, okay, individuals that perpetrated that crime can now have a clean slate. Well, what about the victims?
Yeah.
It seems inconsistent. Yes, we proposed many amendments, but they were rejected along party lines. That's one of the biggest problems with one-party rule. But the other part is, if the House makes the amendment changes, and I hope they see the wisdom of certain crimes and certain individuals not being able to be eligible for that clean slate, it would have to come back to the Senate.
Yeah.
But if the House does it from a standpoint of one-party Democratic rule and pass this through, it's up to the governor to veto it.
All right, we'll see. Tony, thank you. Appreciate it. We'll check in on this down the road. Tony, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Have a great week.
You too, buddy. Thanks. Tony Wong there. All right.